Hi, welcome back to AR Zone. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. These continuing interviews on intersectional veganism and related issues are in association with VegFest UK. In today's interview, Roger and I are pleased to be joined by our special guest, Sarita Rodriguez. Sarita is an author, editor, social justice advocate, and an educator. Their first book, Until Every Animal is Free, was published in 2015, and they're currently working on a compilation of essays examining food justice from a variety of lenses. Sarita's past writings have focused on food justice, veganism, race, and gentrification. Sarita is joining us today to speak about their chapter in the new book, Veganism in an Oppressive World, a Vegans of Colour Community Project. Sarita, welcome back to AR Zone.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Sarita, you recommend in your chapter that animal advocacy organisations striving for a pro-intersectional approach make time in their schedule to support other social justice organisations and causes. For example, hosting one demonstration every other month that's for a cause other than their usual cause. How would you suggest that such organisations ensure that this is not largely performative, akin to including members of marginalized groups primarily to claim diversity?
Thank you very much. That's a really good question. So I agree actually with part of your suggestion there that it's not so much that no groups do this, but unfortunately there is a tendency, even amongst those who do, for it to be somewhat performative. In other words, they'll have one joint event with a particular group, and they'll take some lovely photos, which will make their way onto social media, and then they part ways never to really contribute to one another again. I think one of the main ways in which, there are two important things, actually, I think that would make it easier for animal rights organizations to do this more consistently. One of them is to be careful not to sort of over-program their own events. A lot of groups, they set these agendas that are incredibly full, incredibly demanding, 2, 3, 4 events per week. And then the rest of the week, of course, is spent planning for those events. And that doesn't really leave a lot of room for coalition building if you're constantly hosting your own thing and expecting everyone to come to your thing. That doesn't leave room for you to be truly supportive to other causes. And another thing I think is also to ask the groups directly that you want to support what it is they need. Don't just take it upon yourself to try to pinpoint, oh, well, maybe this will be helpful. Maybe that will be helpful. Contact them directly and see how you can be most useful, because it might be the case that you're not necessarily most useful by attending a particular event, a demonstration, or a meeting, although that is sometimes useful. But it might be, for example, something as simple as, well, one of our leaders has written something very instructive about our perspective. Perhaps you could help us promote it. Or we're currently having a fundraising drive because we're trying to, send food to needy children of farm workers, farm laborers, for example. Or we're trying to, send food out for Thanksgiving or for Christmas. Perhaps you could help us raise awareness about that. So being in touch with the people who you want to support before you show up and try to support them, I think, is really fundamental.
I think your advice is fantastic. Thank you so much. You also write about Oppression Olympics, and you also write that no animal advocate should expect to be taken seriously when expounding the vegan ethos so long as they discriminate against, ostracize, or demonize other humans. I agree with you very much. Could you please elaborate on this a little? And do you have any advice for reaching those animal advocates who refuse to see that racism, sexism, ableism, classism, etc., really do cause a lot of problems both to the movement and therefore to those who we're advocating on behalf of?
There's two questions there. I think I'd actually like to address the second one first, which is the advice aspect of it. And then I'll elaborate a little bit about some examples of what we're really talking about. But in terms of, you said something very interesting. You said those who refuse, if I heard you correctly, those who refuse to see it. And unfortunately, if someone refuses to see something, I don't think there's any way you can force them to. However, for those who are interested in learning more about it, I think the first thing to do is to point to the plethora of writers and activists who are dealing with this work directly. For example, there's a great organization based in the Bay Area of California called Food Empowerment Project, which does a lot of work in solidarity with farm workers, human farm workers, and also promotes a vegan ethos. And so that's a good place to start for people starting to sort of cross the bridge in understanding that connection with human rights and farmers' rights and animal rights. And I'm also actually working on a book coming out later this year, which will hopefully contribute to that conversation. pointing them in the direction of people who are already doing the work helps to quell the, any such argument that, oh, that kind of work can't be done. You have to choose between one cause or another. These causes can't coexist. There's already evidence on the table that they can coexist because people are doing the work, and they've been doing so for several years. That said, in terms of some examples of oppression Olympics, coming from the animal rights movement specifically, there are two different activists I can think of off the top of my head, one of whom is Gary Yourofsky, who actually, this was very disappointing to me personally, because until this point, I was actually a huge supporter of his. I thought he did a very good job of giving very simple and easy to follow arguments against veganism, ones that didn't really require a lot of research, but that are just sort of in your face. You know, for example, the fact that we humans don't have the urge to pounce on an animal and eat that animal when it's got fur and skin and all these other things. Even people who consider themselves carnivores have to process meat in various ways and take this part off and add the seasoning on before they can actually digest it. But unfortunately, sometime I think either last year or maybe even the year before, he came out with a video that was very popular on YouTube entitled Blacks, Palestinians, and Other Hypocrites. And in this video, he demonizes these people of these various cultures and basically makes a mockery of their suffering and the oppression that they're experiencing solely on the grounds that many of them continue to eat meat or wear animals and so on and so forth, as though they're not worthy of our consideration. They're not worthy of our compassion or our time as activists, as social justice advocates. We should just forget these people, forget about Black people, forget about Palestinians, because they're all being hypocritical because they eat meat. And of course, I think that is a very damaging position to take on multiple levels. It does non-human animals a disservice. It does the humans being mentioned a disservice. And I don't see any way to move forward when that is one's mindset. And another example of such things is Freely the Banana Girl. She was a YouTube phenomenon. I don't know if she still is or not, but my understanding is she initially became famous basically just for eating lots of bananas and being very thin. And she was also vegan, and
that's a pretty accurate description.
So you're familiar then?
She lives in Queensland.
Okay, I wasn't quite sure when I, because I don't really watch YouTube, and I'm honestly not on any kind of social media. I don't do Facebook, I don't do Twitter, so I'm always a little bit late to the party when it comes to these things. But I first learned about her because when there was a devastating natural disaster, I believe in Nepal, she released a video basically making the claim that the people who suffered as a result of that natural disaster, they deserved to suffer because of a festival that they held annually in which animals were slaughtered. And by that rationale, you know, one could easily say that everyone in America deserved 9/11 because of hamburgers. You know what I mean? It's like, it's such
absolutely.
You know, and I'm sure there are Australian counterpoint examples of that as well. Oh, we deserve this horrible thing because of that horrible thing that some of us do. So, you know, for this, you know, relatively privileged, you know, thin, blonde, white woman to go online and express that thousands of, you know, impoverished brown people have been being killed from this natural disaster, they all deserve to be killed because of some part of their culture that is not animal friendly, is another example of how this oppression Olympics holds us back and just makes everybody look bad and doesn't truly spread a vegan ethos, one of compassion and one of causing the path of least harm. It does the opposite. It causes more harm.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that you articulated that really, really well. On the topic, just briefly, of Gary Yourofsky, we actually interviewed him back in 2011 and asked him if he regretted any of the comments that he had made in an interview with Claudette Vaughan of Abolitionist Online a few years prior to that. He made some really vicious and hateful and violent comments about his rape fantasies. And yeah, his comments were absolutely appalling. And he said no. Sorry?
He said no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, he said no. He regrets none of those comments.
He regrets none, yes.
No.
So, hi, Sarita. This is Roger here. This is your friendly sociologist. And before I ask the question, I want to second what Carolyn just said about Yourofsky. It was a kind of problem. We're all a little bit impressed by the famous Georgia Tech talk, which is good. And then it all kind of came crashing down, unfortunately. But there you go. Anyway, onwards and upwards, as they say. On page 87 of the book version, you suggest a few ways that the mainstream animal community has failed to respect less privileged activists. For example, you talk about the expectation of attending certain conferences or only eating exclusively at places which are 100% vegan, and you also suggest that anyone who spends time in the company of somebody who eats byproducts from animals is a bad activist. So can you talk a little bit more about this point, please?
Sure. So, for example, the thing about eating either in restaurants that aren't exclusively vegan or in the presence of people who are eating, you know, animal products, there are sort of two main reasons that people give for this. One of them I'm more sympathetic to than the other, but ultimately I don't think either of them really holds water. The first is it's an emotional issue. It's emotionally painful for one to see that happening. That's the one that I empathize with more because it's painful for me too. Of course I understand that. Once you open your eyes to the violence that, you know, that meal is the result of, it's impossible to look at it any other way. And so I can empathize with that a little bit. And then there are those on the other side who say, independent of any emotional pain, that we shouldn't do this because it's bad for the movement. That if we're truly, if we're very dedicated to disseminating our message, to being strong and bold about our message and not equivocating and not compromising, then we need to be, it's an example of ethical consistency for these individuals to not sit at table with someone who is consuming an animal byproduct. My issue is that it does have very racist and especially very classist overtones, in the sense that, for example, if I'm sitting on a park bench in New York City, if I go outside and I sit on a bench and there's a homeless man nearby and he is eating a sandwich that someone gave to him, and that sandwich happens to have meat or cheese or something else that I don't approve of in it, does this mean that all of a sudden I don't have a reason to speak to this person? He doesn't have a reason to speak to me. Nothing that he could say is valuable and I shouldn't care about his plight? I mean, there's a grand assumption being made there that anybody who is consuming any of these things is doing so by choice. And yes, technically I understand that they are, in the sense that you can always choose to have nothing, right? Nothing is an option. But over time, you know, it can be a deadly option. So that's one reason that I disapprove of this tactic, is that it immediately lends itself to more privileged vegans sort of spending less and less time with people of lower income levels. Another thing is, you know, there are other reasons that one might be able, just as a quick aside, this is part of the same reason, but aside from having low income, there are myriad other reasons you might not have access to whatever choices that you might want to have. For instance, people living in various institutional settings, people in hospitals, people in prisons, people in mental institutions. These people don't have a say in what they eat. They're given a plate of food once or twice a day and they eat it or they don't, and that's it. They don't have the privilege of shopping. So, you know, again, you know, when you make these sort of hard lines in the sand like that, you're taking huge swaths of the population and you're saying these people aren't worthy of our consideration because they're not living the lifestyle that we're living right now, and that makes them inferior. And we need to teach them how inferior they are by not spending any time with them whatsoever. So if you follow this argument to its logical conclusion, what you get is not the dissemination of the vegan ethos, which is what these people purport to want. What you get is vegans clustering themselves up in a vegan bubble and no one else is allowed in. You see?
Yes. Thanks for that. I think that probably some people might think that, you know, they might interpret this as you suggesting that we, as it were, kind of lower the bar a little bit on veganism in the way that, say, the reducitarians are suggesting. But I don't think you're really saying that, really. You're just kind of saying take people's circumstances into consideration, aren't you, really?
Yes, and I do think that rather than sort of accept, like, I think I know where you're going in the sense of with reducitarians and whatnot, and that there are those who would argue, because of the reasons I've just cited as to why certain people might be caught having something that isn't vegan, that this is a reason to not promote global veganism, that this is a reason for us to just stop because there are these barriers that I've just listed, and accept that not everybody's going to do it. On the contrary, I think these are things that we need to work towards changing, and there are groups that are already doing that. With respect to homelessness, for example, and getting back to veganism in an oppressive world for a minute, one of the many things that I enjoyed about working on that project and that I was very grateful for is that it introduced me to the work of Michelle Carrera, who has an organization called Chili's on Wheels, and this organization gives vegan food to the poor. And they actually, I'm very grateful for the fact that they have a branch in Puerto Rico that they've recently reactivated in response to the devastation of Hurricane Maria. And so they are currently down there feeding vegan food to the people. And Food Not Bombs is another example. They have a few sites overseas, but I think they're mostly based here in America in various cities. And again, they address that problem by preparing vegan food for the needy. So things like that and making sure there are vegan options in prison and in hospitals and all of that is doable. And those should all be goals that we're working towards. Those aren't reasons to give up. Those are reasons to push on.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, what you said about the Food Not Bombs, there is an active Food Not Bombs group in Dublin, so that's pretty good. I'm kind of involved with, or at least I help with that. And there's also somebody...
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, somebody in Belfast who is trying to organise vegan food for some prisoners.
That's wonderful. I'm glad to hear it.
Sarita, you mentioned vegans choosing not to sit down, for example, with a homeless person because they might be eating a cheese sandwich. I think that when we make choices like that, we're also perpetuating the notion of veganism being very privileged and very white. And I think that that's one of the last things that we need to do.
Absolutely.
Along those lines, you also write about the suggestion that all animal advocates move to an urban activist hub.
Yes.
To what extent does this map onto virtual communities as well? For example, those that reject veganism or fail to address human oppression, when should we stay in problematic online spaces and when should we leave them? If we leave, violence can continue unchecked, but if we stay, we can continue to challenge such behaviour, but that risks granting them legitimacy. And that's without even considering the emotional labour. Like, do you have an opinion on that?
I'm familiar with some of these things from the brief time that I did spend on Facebook. I never had a Twitter account, but I had a Facebook once upon a time for two different periods. And so I recognized some of this, but I did ultimately leave it. And this is one of the reasons that I personally choose actually not to be on social media. I do think that it ultimately does more harm than good. I understand that it's a great way to promote initiatives. It's a great way to collect signatures and to bring people out. For events, you know, any given event you want to throw, if you make a Facebook page for it, you'll get 3, 4, 5 times as many people at that event as you would otherwise. That's just the nature of the beast. But ultimately, I do think that in-person conversations or even conversations via email in which there's a more of a private feeling to them. There's no audience. It's just two people exchanging ideas in which, you know, the end game is to for everyone to sharpen their understanding of the issue. I do think that's preferable. Once you involve an audience, the end game for very few people, even if they're not necessarily conscious of this, the end game ceases to be just about let's get the best understanding of this issue as we can. Let's get the most well-rounded and comprehensive understanding of this as we can. There's a competitive element that seeps into the conversation. When you know that others are watching, there's a fear of losing. There's a fear of humiliation that takes place, and that makes people increasingly aggressive and increasingly insistent in a way that isn't helpful. And so that's why this whole trend of having these discussions in such a way that, you know, literally anybody can just hop on and watch and they supposedly do have moderators, but there's only so much that the time and attention that those people can spend moderating. And so you do end up sometimes with really filthy things, you know, vulgar things being said completely off topic. It gets out of hand very quickly. And I'm not sure I have any good advice for how to necessarily prevent that. I can only say that, you know, you can stay in that conversation as long as you feel comfortable and make your best efforts to make it valuable. But if it starts to get to a point where you're suffering, and it's become clear to you that the person or persons on the other side are not really listening to you anymore, then it's best probably to just walk away or close the window or whatever whatever term one says for situations like that.
I actually think that's really, really good advice. And I think it's really, really spot on that you said that a lot of people when speaking on a public Facebook page will be playing to the audience. And it does become a competition. And it's about winning and not losing. And I think that if we're in a conversation like that, it's really important to remember that so that we know that we can walk away and know when to walk away when that sort of thing's happening, because we're not reaching that person.
Right.
So, Sarita, is there anything that we haven't covered today that you'd like to speak with us about?
Yes, actually, if you don't mind, I would like to tell you a little bit about an upcoming project I have. Do we have time?
We do, absolutely.
Okay. So, as you know, the book that you had originally wanted to speak about, Veganism in an Impressive World, was published by Sanctuary Publishers in November. And now sometime this spring, we don't have an exact date yet, but we're looking at April or May of 2018. We'll have another one coming out called Food Justice, A Primer. And that one, like everything that I write, of course, has a vegan lens, but it's going to be a little bit more broadly focused on issues of accessibility and farmers' rights and things like that. And I'm very excited about this because it's not just my writing. I am contributing maybe 3 or 4 different parts to it, but I have a laundry list of really amazing contributors on board. Pax Gethin is one of them. They are a trans and vegan activist from California, and also a gifted photographer, by the way. They attend all sorts of demonstrations, protests, animal sanctuaries, and they just take the most lovely, beautiful photos. And also Don Moncrief of A Well-Fed World will be joining us, which is a wonderful foundation in Washington, D.C. that is, again, I think I might have actually mentioned them a little bit earlier, but they're like Food Empowerment Project in that they do a really brilliant job of marrying solving hunger issues through a vegan praxis and remaining committed to veganism while also reaching out to the most needy. Just one quick example of a program they have is that they have vegan free lunches going out to elementary and perhaps also high school, I'm not sure, but at least elementary school students in Ethiopia. So she will also be contributing. So really one of the primary aims of the book is getting back to what you'd asked me earlier about oppression Olympics and whatnot, is like I'm hoping that this project will be one of many different steps that various people are taking to sort of bridge this divide that persists between human hunger workers and animal rights workers. We really need to bring those two communities together, not just for non-human animals or for human animals, but also for the sake of the planet. And some of our contributors to this project will speak more specifically about environmental issues. They're a lot more knowledgeable about that than I am, so I'm very grateful to have those folks on board especially. But we really need to bring these two camps together for myriad reasons, not least of which is for the sake of our planet, in order to ensure that all of these sentient beings have something to live on in, you know, 50 or 100 years. I really think it's crucial. And I think there's been a lot of suspicion and mistrust built up between these two camps, being convinced that they have to fight over funding, they have to fight over ideology, they have to fight over volunteers. And really, there's no need for any of that. They're really two sides of the same coin, and I'm hoping that this book will highlight that.
That sounds very exciting. I really look forward to it. It will give us an excuse to get you back to speak with us too. Sarita, thank you so much for giving us your time today. And I also wanted to thank you so much. The work that you're doing is changing the world, and it's something that I hope that you're really proud of. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you. No member of the animal kingdom nurses past maturity. No member of the animal kingdom ever did a thing to me. So I don't eat red meat or